1, 2, 3, 4.
Because the fact that he was intellectually gifted, that came about because I interviewed his uncle, with whom he lived for the first 5 years of his life in a multi-generational household in Brooklyn. And when I talked with his uncle, and also Jean-Michel's cousin, who was the son of that uncle, they talked about how he was reading New York Times articles when he was in first grade. And they just talked about how intelligent and wickedly smart he was. So that led me to go down the path of reading all the research on gifted children. What I learned is that gifted children have this remarkable ability to absorb information and find patterns in them that others don't see. So Jean-Michel exhibited all these characteristics, and it became a huge door opener for me to understand his work because, you know, for 40 years, I've seen most of his paintings. And so it was just that visual cacophony. There had to be something deeper than him just having visual acuity. All of the great artists are there for a reason because they rebelled in some way. They created a visual vocabulary that felt fresh and new, that excited people. So the great artists are not built on sort of anthills of sand. They're built on things of substance and of meaning, though is not a sufficient condition to become an icon. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition. I think you have to have an interesting and vivid personality or personal narrative that makes you interesting for people to talk about and want to learn about. I think you also have to have a support network of galleries, of curators, collectors who are excited about your work and want to push it forward and don't want it to be forgotten. Basquiat's visual vocabulary is distinctive, stands out relative to what was being done in the 1980s. And so that's the sort of strong hill on which his reputation is built. But, you know, Basquiat benefited from being the first Black artist of note that got pushed forward. And as in many things, the first benefits. People today are so used to Basquiat's prices being extraordinarily high and rising that it's almost hard for people to understand that wasn't the case. In the year he died, 1988, you know, a terrific painting by Basquiat might have sold for $30,000 relative to his other artistic peers. Like a great Julian Schnabel painting cost $800,000. After he died, some speculative capital entered his market and his prices did pop. But in the early 1990s, his prices fell apart. And for much of the first half of the 1990s, his work was selling for 80% off what it had been selling before. Auction houses didn't want to include him in their auctions. And so there was a really good chance he was going to be remembered, but certainly not become a great star. And so there were three key figures who believed in him, proceeded to buy almost every available Basquiat in the first half of the 1990s. They were also just passionate believers in his work. And but for those three people, you know, it would have taken decades before Basquiat would have achieved acclaim, if ever.
Today, we're joined by someone uniquely positioned to unpack the art world's inner workings and to help us understand one of its most mythic figures, Jean-Michel Basquiat. Doug Woodham is the author of a new biography, Jean-Michel Basquiat, The Making of an Icon, the first major life study of Basquiat in over 25 years. Drawing on more than 100 interviews from family and friends to collectors and curators, Doug traces the rise, fall, and resurrection of an artist who redefined what it means to be a cultural icon. Before turning to writing, Doug served as president of the Americas for Christie's, one of the world's leading auction houses. That role gave him an insider's perspective on how value is created and mythologized in the modern art market. In this conversation, we'll explore not just the man behind the legend, but the powerful machinery that turned Jean-Michel Basquiat into one of the most recognized and commercially successful artists in the world. Doug Woodham, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you, Mia. Thank you for asking me to join you.
So, you know, before we get into the conversation, I believe you're going to share a passage with our listeners from the introduction of your book.
Yes, I created a selection from the introduction. So my fascination with Jean-Michel Basquiat took root when I moved to New York City in the early 1980s. Though his name was familiar to those of us who followed the contemporary art world, opportunities to see his work firsthand were scarce. I was delighted when his name appeared in the New York Times review of a group exhibition featuring 400 artists. Eager to see his work, I visited the exhibition space, which was a sprawling, abandoned army depot in Brooklyn. But after wandering through what was a very dystopian venue, I was unable to find any of his pieces. Frustrated, I returned to the entrance and asked the person at the front desk where the work was displayed. I was told that Basquiat's paintings had been removed due to concerns about theft, as his pieces had suddenly become highly sought after. While my plans to see his work that day were thwarted, my interest in his art only deepened. Jean-Michel Basquiat, the Brooklyn-born artist who died of a drug overdose in 1988 at 27, currently stands alongside a handful of others at the very pinnacle of what a visual artist can hope to achieve in our world. When one of his paintings sold for $110.5 million at auction in 2017, he joined the very exclusive $100 million club alongside luminaries such as Picasso and Modigliani. The streets of Rio de Janeiro, Paris, and Singapore are filled with people of all ages wearing t-shirts, shoes, and accessories featuring his artwork or image. Some fans even express their admiration permanently through Basquiat-inspired tattoos. His cultural impact is so far-reaching that he's become a frequent answer on the game show Jeopardy. But Basquiat's ascension into these parallel pantheons of fine art and pop culture was far from certain. Despite starting life with the gifts of a sharp intellect, his family recalled him reading articles in the New York Times by first grade, in a financially stable middle-class home. He was sidetracked by profound early personal traumas. By his teenage years, he had dropped out of high school and was living on the streets. Without any formal training as an artist, and initially wanting to be a cartoonist, a shy and somewhat fragile young man, he also had to face down the challenge of penetrating the elitist contemporary art world of the early 1980s, where Black artists struggled to find recognition and acceptance. So how did Basquiat's work overcome so many obstacles, both during his brief life and after his death, to achieve such a critical and commercial acclaim? Like a deity with a broad scope of jurisdiction, he has become a patron saint to many. Basquiat, the artistic visionary. Basquiat, the truth-telling Black activist. Basquiat, the outsider. Yet he was also a real person driven by relatable human motivations. Since attending that Brooklyn exhibition, I've followed Basquiat's trajectory throughout my career as a partner at a global management consulting firm, president of Christie's America, the International Auction House, and an art advisor to collectors and institutions. What these roles have provided me with is an insider's view of the forces driving the blue chip art market, a world often shrouded in opacity, as if its inner workings were best kept behind the canvas. Yet this labyrinth and occasionally contentious system underscores a broader truth. Understanding how art is valued illuminates why certain artists rise to prominence. Whether one likes to think about it or not, the works that dominate attention and secure pride of place in leading museums and collections have all, at some point, passed a demanding market test. Since the publication of what was long considered the definitive biography of Basquiat over 25 years ago, much has changed with respect to his reputation and in the market for his work. In writing my book, I've drawn on over 100 interviews with those connected to Basquiat, as well as newly available documents about his early life and brief career. These sources help me to uncover fresh insights into his life and art while correcting elements of what has become the accepted narrative. Unraveling the myth to connect with the gifted child, teenager, and young artist who would have turned 65 this year is the focus of the first part of my book. Basquiat's personal biography ended tragically in 1988, and until now, that was largely where the story stopped. My other goal in writing this book was to present the biography of his work's survival and how, in the decades since his untimely death, both the artist and his work have attained an almost mythical status. The legacy of any great artist extends beyond their lifetime, often shaped by a small group of individuals who, motivated by varied interests, ensure the work continues to be seen, known, and experienced. For Basquiat, this was particularly true, given the significant obstacles his work had to overcome to secure the recognition it enjoys today. Additionally, his posthumous reputation was further strengthened by a shift among curators and academics toward examining art through the prism of identity, exploring how an artist's race, gender, and sexuality inform their engagement with themes such as oppression, discrimination, and inequality. Basquiat not only embodied this evolving paradigm of artistic relevance, but also helped to define it. How these and other forces combined to elevate Basquiat's legacy until now, the missing chapters of his story are the focus of the second half of my book. The art world, like many creative industries, selects and elevates its luminaries in ways that can appear enigmatic, inscrutable, or even arbitrary. Yet its influence on our cultural landscape is profound. It is my hope that the stories I share about Jean-Michel Basquiat's against all odds journey from his Brooklyn childhood to the pinnacle of the art world will help readers understand the surprising and often hidden reasons why his paintings, rather than another artist, are on t-shirts worn by people around the world, on the walls of billionaires, and remain such a source of inspiration to creatives globally.
Wow, you say so much in that introduction. In fact, you touched on so many of my questions, actually. But it just shows us the power of Basquiat as an artist, you know, that his story speaks to each of us in its specificity in such a universal way that we can all,
yes,
you know, read ourselves into his story. And I think that you illuminate quite a few things that we really didn't know. And then, of course, that whole other layer of the life of the artist after their death, which is a kind of strange contradiction to bear in mind. But, you know, one of the things that I found interesting that I don't think has been focused on as much as you said there is that you identify him as being an intellectually gifted child, and that often the narrative is just, well, he was very free. This is stuff is he's just dancing it out and putting it on the canvas. But from a very early age, he was a bit like, in a different way, like Da Vinci. He was constantly absorbing and learning different ideas and finding connections. And now when I look at the paintings through this new lens, I can, that's really true. Because I think, and to go further into that Da Vinci metaphor, which I know you also address, and he was also in dialogue with all these great artists as well, is that you see Basquiat's creative mind at work. And I think that people really love learning. And that's why I feel like if you look at his paintings, maybe comparing them to Da Vinci or someone, he's created this giant, boldly colored codex and put so many puzzles and enigmas in his paintings that I feel like he knew people will be talking about them for years to come.
Love the way that you think about it and talk about it. Yeah, because the fact that he was intellectually gifted, that came about because I interviewed his uncle, with whom he lived for the first 5 years of his life in a multi-generational household in Brooklyn. And when I talked with his uncle and also Jean-Michel's cousin, who was the son of that uncle, they talked about how he was reading New York Times articles when he was in first grade. And I remember stopping them. I said, say that again, because I hadn't heard that ever before. And they just talked about how intelligent and wickedly smart he was. So that led me to go down the path of reading all the research on gifted children. And there's just a huge body of work. And so I tracked down two leading academics who helped me understand how to distill that body of research down to what was relevant for somebody like Jean-Michel. From all that research, what I learned is that gifted children, and we're talking 1% gifted, have this remarkable ability to absorb information and find patterns in them that others don't see. They pursue interests passionately and go down rabbit holes really quickly. They retain that information for long periods of time and are able to just sort of see the world through a sort of mature lens at an early age that for many gifted children is somewhat terrifying when they're young because they're seeing things that are beyond their sort of emotional comprehension, but they're trying to figure out what's going on. So Jean-Michel exhibited all these characteristics from the people I interviewed, and it became a huge door opener for me to understand his work because, you know, for 40 years, I've seen most of his paintings. And so it was just that visual cacophony. There had to be something deeper than him just having visual acuity.
Yeah, indeed. And it's so interesting that it could have gone many other ways too, because we don't know. That's the tragedy, that he lost his mature phase. He could have gone further into music. He was just, like with any really talented, or if you want to use the word genius, it just finds an avenue to express itself. But I feel that is a loss that he could have even then gone into filmmaking and a variety of things since he was so curious.
Right. The one thing about that is, look, part of his charm to people is he did die young. And so we're not having to suffer through seeing a sort of bald, fat Basquiat doing stuff. So there is just this romantic notion of the artist who was taken early, which I think just creates a certain pathos, a certain attachment that many people have, including myself, because there is just this sense of loss associated with somebody who was so gifted. And his intelligence was also part of the reason why I figured out how to navigate the art world. Because again, people always play with discrimination themes when it comes to Basquiat, which I think are important and relevant. But because he was so smart and he felt comfortable dealing with people of different genders, sexualities, economic backgrounds, I mean, he was sort of socially adept. He was able to figure out how to penetrate this world, which also solved a bit of a mystery for me, because there were lots of Black artists who were active in the 70s and 80s who were competing for attention. But Basquiat, I think because of his intelligence, was sort of able to figure out how to navigate that and how to penetrate it and how to play into that marketplace so he could achieve recognition that he wanted.
Yeah, so much about being an artist is about not just communicating visually, but communicating in that world. And so I always do wonder about, well, we should all always wonder, you know, what drives people? And you touch upon it. He had this drive. Was it pursuing fame, or the need to express something, to heal old wounds through the safety of art? I mean, what do you feel ultimately, because of all the people you've interviewed, they have different takes on it.
Right. Look, his parents were ambitious, and they were upwardly mobile and success-oriented. I think he felt the same way. He wanted to be successful. He wanted to leave his mark. He wanted to express himself. And so I think those were sort of innate skills that he thrived on. He also wanted to be recognized by others. He was very interested in achieving acclaim, being famous, and accomplishing things that others didn't. He had a lot of self-confidence in his ability to figure things out. And so part of my personal attachment to Jean-Michel is there's something very appealing about that, because I think that's true for most of the very successful artists throughout history. And so that sort of commercial sensibility, that drive, that ambition oftentimes gets sublimated when people talk about creatives that they wanted to achieve, they wanted to dominate, they wanted to be part of the well-known. And I think that's something that drove them. And I think that's something we should recognize and honor around artists, as opposed to just thinking they're sort of creative characters and figures. And we should just, you know, sort of be so appreciative of their creativity. And we should be, but I think there are deeper motivations on their part that drove them.
So you talk about him navigating all these worlds, whether it's within visual arts. I mean, Andy Warhol was kind of a father figure, collaborator, you know, Madonna and all that. So this upper level that he navigates, at the same time, maintaining friendships, losing friendships. We're talking about a very short period, so you can't say, but with people who were not as well known, who knew him, like just coming up. Who do you feel knew him the best? I mean, you know, if you could say the real Basquiat.
What an interesting question. He was a private person. He lived in a sort of, at times, flamboyant way. But I think he was careful. In interviews, he revealed essentially nothing. He was very enigmatic. And I think he knew that for many creatives, it's best to be enigmatic because you want your audience to sort of map themselves onto the work. But I think their girlfriends and boyfriends, I think he let his guard down and revealed things. I think to his cousin, who I was able to interview extensively, who he was very close to and that he lived with for a period of time, he ended up revealing a lot to his cousin and also to his gallerists, Nina Nozay and Bruno Bischofberger. He just would be open to sharing with them because he was engaged at times in sort of intellectual dialogue with them about art, intellectual dialogue about the world at large, intellectual dialogue about what motivated artists in the past and what he could draw from it. So there's this sort of mosaic of people that I interviewed to try and get my sense of him. I was interested in trying to get to some more inner truths about who he was, as opposed to salacious tales about who he was having sex with and his drug-taking habits.
Yeah, it's a mosaic of people, truly. You mean the cousin you mean, is that Christine Whaley you're talking about?
No, actually, his cousin was Ruben Andrade's junior, who was born 3 months after Jean-Michel. And you know, they lived together the first 5 years of Jean-Michel's life. And that cousin was very close to Jean-Michel up until he died.
You know, speaking of connections, I had the opportunity to interview Lee Jaffe, who, as you know, traveled with Basquiat through Asia and Europe in the early 80s. And I think, you know, what emerges from his recollections and photographs of that time and from others, as you've interviewed, who knew him, is a very sensitive and thoughtful person, very, very different from Basquiat, the icon. So you'd also write about talking about legacy and how it was built by these different visionary gallerists, speculators, and of course, his father, Gerard, reviving his work nearly a decade after his death and reshaping his legacy, because it wasn't a straight line trajectory upwards. I mean, yeah, he was sure he was on covers of Time, I think, and different magazines and very popular, but he wasn't always the most solid blue chip artist that he has become today. So could you just tell us how all these different elements factored into the Basquiat we know today and how he's valued by the market? And we shouldn't neglect, of course, the auction house's role in this as well.
So people today are so used to Basquiat's prices being extraordinarily high and rising that it's almost hard for people to understand that wasn't the case. In the year he died, 1988, you know, a terrific painting by Basquiat might have sold for $30,000. He might have been somewhat well known within the contemporary art world, but relative to his other artistic peers, like a great Julian Schnabel painting cost $800,000. A great painting by other sort of neo-expressionists were $250,000. Basquiat's was $30,000. I guess second is, after he died, some speculative capital entered his market and his prices did pop. But in the early 1990s, his prices fell apart. And for much of the first half of the 1990s, his work was selling for 80% off what it had been selling before. Auction houses didn't want to include him in their auctions. Galleries weren't showing his work. So in the early 1990s, he was more of the forgotten man. The art world is a place where once your prices fall, it's hard to reignite interest. For Basquiat in particular, there was a taint around him in the early 1990s because a lot of collectors felt that he gained fame because of his association and relationship with Warhol and the fact that he died young. There really wasn't an intellectual framework to situate Basquiat in the sort of history of art. And so there was a really good chance he was going to be remembered, but certainly not become a great star. And so there were some three key figures who believed in him, thought that there was a market opportunity associated with him, and proceeded to buy almost every available Basquiat in the first half of the 1990s that became available. And so they were collectors, they were speculators, they were investors, they were also just passionate believers in his work. And but for those three people, you know, it would have taken decades before Basquiat would have achieved acclaim, if ever.
And this is Jose Mograbe, Peter Brandt, and Rico Navarra.
Yes, yes. These three folks, two who lived in New York, one who lived in Paris. They collaborated sometimes. They competed with each other. But look, across the three of them, they bought hundreds of Basquiat works. They also separately created packaged museum shows that they offered to secondary museums around the world who took them up on the offer. One of them created what is not really a catalog raisonné, but has become the book of record of all the works by Basquiat, and proceeded to give this 12-pound multi-volume book away to 25,000 people over the course of the 1990s and the 2000s. I mean, nothing like that had ever been done, and nothing like that's ever been done since. So these three men are a really important reason why the kids in Singapore are wearing T-shirts and sneakers that are emblazoned with Basquiat imagery. For the first time ever, detailed profiles of them, their stories, and what they did to identify and promote and evangelize Basquiat are a really important part of the second half of the book.
Yeah, in a way, it is a It is actually a creative process, just like some people don't think about it, but creating a business is a creative process. Creating a mystique around, of course, without the art, nothing could be done. There are all these kind of symbols, I think, that really helps us get intellectually engaged, and it really helps us have whatever narrative, which is kind of unusual, whatever narrative we bring to it. I mean, most narratives, you talk about identity, his identity, critiques on racism, colonialism, but then the personal biography element, you talk about early trauma or the rupture of his parents' marriage and how that affected him. So you can just revisit the art, which is so, I think, important now. I mean, we're now in the age of AI and generative art where everything has this perfect sheen. And I think it's, for me personally, to just go back to something that has that, and people talk about his energy, the energy of the initial mark, you know, and then the crossing out. We feel like, oh, these are pages. I feel like these are pages of the diary that we never received.
Yes. You know, the thing that's wonderful about his work is when you stand in front of it, there's just something so intriguing and interesting and beautiful. And even for those who know nothing about him, his great paintings will sort of stop them in their tracks. He reveled in doing large-scale paintings. He also reveled in doing many drawings, obsessive-compulsive drawings. I think one challenge to understanding Basquiat's work is there's not much of it that's available for anybody to see in a public museum. There's a museum in Los Angeles, the Broad Museum, that has 13 paintings by him, and they often have them up on view. And then there's a private museum in Zug, Switzerland, that has an extensive collection of his work. But it's actually really hard to see his work. People are forced to just see it in books, which is too bad because he was making 6 by 6 foot paintings, 10 by 12 foot paintings. And the visceral impact of standing in front of them is so much a part of their charm and their appeal. And so I oftentimes have conversations with people who've only seen his work in reproduction and paintings, and they're always like, you know, I'm not sure I get it, Doug. And oftentimes I have to just sort of explain, you know, we got to find a place where we can go see them live. His drawings are actually the best place on small scale to see his works. Because, you know, he had an OCD, like sort of, he would obsessively draw. And his great drawings are a great place to see how he chose to think about the world and how he chose to express things. Look, my great hope is that someday there's going to be a collector or a museum that can have a little capsule collection of, you know, 10, 15 paintings on view. I think since many of his collectors who bought him early are in their 70s, 80s, and sometimes even in their 90s, my hope is when they die, and in the United States, they're going to have to pay massive estate taxes, maybe they'll donate a clutch of his paintings. And maybe the Princeton University Art Museum will have 8 or 10 of them. I think that would be wonderful because I think, not that his reputation needs to be pushed even more, but I think that visceral sense of being able to stand in front of multiple works and just enjoy them, it would be a great experience for that to happen.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. But you point to another thing, which is so many people receive them in reproduction or graphically on screens. And I think that also speaks to the artists that have really endured over the ages do have that graphic element. So I think it does really reproduce well. But I also feel like in some ways, a lot of people are losing that ability to see the actual work. I mean, it's kind of sad when you go to museums sometimes and everyone's on their phones, and even like I've toured museums with like our critics and historians, and sometimes they too are not looking. But we need to learn how to see slowly again, I feel.
Yes, I think that's true. People's attention spans have shrunk. People are distracted. I think people doom scroll. And so I think it is hard at times for people to step back and pause. I think it was the New York Times that started recently a feature piece of looking at something for 10 minutes and thinking about it and reflecting upon it. Basquiat's work benefits from that because there is just so much enigmatic imagery in it. He loved these sort of weird juxtapositions of content. And if you just stop and pause and think and enjoy, you can see a lot in his work in much the same way you can in a great Picasso, Monet, in great Kandinsky. I mean, these are works that benefit from calm, that benefit from moments of reflection, and benefit from you deciding what you see in it and how you react to it, as opposed to reading wall labels to figure out what others want to project onto it. Yeah. And that you feel compelled, well, should I parrot that? Is that what I think? And so many people love Basquiat's work because they might have heard something about him, and there's sort of a search to understand his imagery, which is a lovely, wonderful thing for an artist to achieve.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always try to have the impression first before I receive the commentary. But sometimes, I mean, as you say, for someone who is so literary and full of ideas, it's important to have both. They actually speak his paintings in very interesting ways. And I don't know what it is, if I just say, for me personally, there's so many exciting things about them, but it's like, it affects us on some kind of subconscious level. It's you mentioned Picasso, you know, it's like, or looking at African masks or looking at the moon, you know, this thing that all our ancestors have looked at or connected with. So it goes kind of deep into our subconscious. And that's something that kind of vibrates there in Basquiat's paintings for me.
Yes, I think many people share those feelings and those sympathies. And I think, you know, God bless, I hope people can see some of his large paintings, because there is something just so cool about standing in front of a 6-foot square painting with all these sort of jagged crossed out words. He would use oil stick, which leaves traces. The work from 81, 82, and 83, which many people, including myself, think is just the high point of his career. They're like 100 to 200 paintings that are just so cool to stand in front of. And you don't need to over-intellectualize them. You don't have to read volumes to disentangle what's there. You can just sort of revel in their scale and be quizzical about what was going on, what was he thinking, and what do you see?
And so you speak about also, I mean, art can really be a spiritual experience, or at least a meditative one. The way, and I have to say, the way you speak about art, it's not as I would expect for, I mean, obviously you're at Christie's and all this, but I know your background is you have a PhD in economics. So you don't speak like someone who has a PhD in economics. This is the first kind of, I've interviewed some economists, but they don't speak that way about art. So it's very interesting. So often, you know, we cite the great artists like Van Gogh, their art offers a spiritual or a meditative experience to people, but we know it lived alongside the chaos of their lives. Right. And maybe we have to have that trauma in order to, you know, suffering lives alongside beauty. To offer something that really speaks to people deeply, we have to kind of go through that experience. But I always sometimes feel, I don't like to make it in such nostalgic terms, because I know this is kind of also the trope of talking about artists, but I sometimes feel sad for the artist to have to go through that to give us such beauty.
I think most of the great artists that people flock to see in museums, you know, most of them have had some sort of trauma, angst, frustration, anger that fuels their work. I mean, there are exceptions. Manet, for example, who's just a great artist. I think Manet lived a very nice life. I think Cézanne lived a very nice life. I mean, I think you've got to sort of search for angst in their careers. I'm sure if you search hard enough, you can find it. But I think for most artists, there's some trauma, anger, ambition, overcoming, you know, disdain by parents that motivate and drive them that might show up in their imagery, but certainly shows up in their drive and ambition to be successful. And I think most of the great artists and most of the great creatives throughout history, I think a good way to approach them is to understand, why were they so ambitious? Why were they so driven? Why did they keep banging away in their efforts to be recognized? Because understanding what drove their ambition is oftentimes a good way to understand what was going on in their brain and why is what's on those canvases and then their drawings there.
Yeah, and I think you come to many answers to that question for Basquiat. What drove his ambition?
I think it's true. Because he was intellectually gifted and he felt confident in his ability to figure things out, I think he figured, I can become a great artist. Toward the end of his life, when he was tired of producing and had massive drug issues, he was thinking of pivoting to becoming more of a writer. There's one beautiful vignette in the book of him being photographed in Paris 6 months before he died and talking with the photographer about it. He was tired of the art world, didn't want to be in it anymore, and wanted to be a writer. And Basquiat talked about how his friends in New York sort of giggled and told him, why do you ever think you could be a writer? He talked about, I'm going to become a writer much the same way I figured out how to be a painter. I figured it out and I did it. There's something cool about that. I think he also wanted the love and admiration of his dad, with whom he had a fractious relationship. I think he knew that he had this fragile background. He was a fragile person. And so I think that fragility he wanted to exhibit and he wanted to show. And, you know, there's one passage in the book where I talk about this incredibly poignant painting that he did of his mom, inspired by his mom's schizophrenia. It came to a head when he was 7. She had a nervous breakdown after his parents split up in a very violent way. His mom actually attacked his dad with a hammer. The father left the townhouse that they owned, and she was institutionalized for a period, and she actually chose not to raise the children, but to ask Jean-Michel's father to do that. He was 7 years old. Can you imagine, you know, certainly in the 1960s, people didn't divorce, people didn't separate. Moms didn't, you know, sort of give up their children to be raised by their dad. I mean, he was remarkably close with his mother, and the mother remained close throughout his life, but he was thrust into this acute state of otherness when he was quite young. There's this painting that's called Masonic Lodge that I just love because it's a portrait of his mom. The references to schizophrenia are sort of buried in this painting. But once you understand his mom suffering with schizophrenia, how that manifested itself in a very vivid way when Jean-Michel was 7, and how he had to live with the consequences of that for the rest of his life and never really overcame it. When you understand that, it's a portrait of his mom struggling with the effects of schizophrenia. And it's this very coded painting that, unless you know this backstory, you'd have no idea what's going on. But once you understand it's a portrait of his mom dealing with schizophrenia and the impact it had on him personally, it's one of my favorite paintings by him. The fact that he chose to paint this and to reveal this, but in a way that's so coded that there are probably, up until my book, you know, 10 people on the planet that understood what was going on in this painting.
Yeah, it's a kind of crying woman crying. And that might be something behind his productivity and searching for fame too, the shadow of schizophrenia. Is it going to come for me? You know, I'll keep busy and I'll keep on producing, examining the thoughts in my mind, making sure they don't run ahead of me, and maybe the drug taking, you know, numbing it.
So the drug taking, a really important point. I mean, there's a long passage in the book about the impact of his drug addictions on his art and his productivity. And so many creatives throughout history have relied on heroin and drugs, and it's not a new thing. I was really interested in trying to understand, what about his heroin use? What did that contribute to his productivity, to his mindset, to his attitudes? And it's interesting, if you read the literature on heroin addictions, you can't find anything in there that suggests anything positive about heroin. And that's for reasons, because it's addictive, it's horrible. It's like, it's not a good path to go down. And so all the literature is about, it's awful, it's evil, it's terrible. You know, jazz musicians, some of the literature on jazz will talk about it, freeing. But I finally found somebody who knew Basquiat very well, who met him when he was young, who didn't have a heroin addiction, per se, but he knew William Burroughs, and he talked about the impact of heroin on creatives. And it was a door-opening interview because he talked about how with relatively small doses of heroin, it pulls the worry cord out of the socket for artists. You know, artists are walking on a tightrope or trying to figure out what to create, how to create things of note. And he said heroin is actually an elixir in the early stages. And he talked about there's almost a three-year heroin honeymoon where when you're using it, you can work for extended periods of time. Your worry cord has been pulled from the socket. And life is great, life is exalted, life is wonderful. Much of the great work that Basquiat created, 82, 83, was when he was using heroin. And so this interview helped understand the positive impacts that heroin had on unleashing his creativity. But it, of course, came to bite him in the ass, and his addictions surged at some point. And actually, a lot of the work that he made the last couple of years of his life are sort of vague echoes of what he was doing in his great years, in part because he becomes so listless on heroin and was just sort of banging out work for exhibitions. I wouldn't want to say they're pastiches, but they sort of hint at his greatness. There are some phenomenal great works in his last 2 years that stand with his best works, but he had more hits than misses. But heroin is dirty, ugly, awful. But I was so happy to finally understand what impact it had on him as a young artist. And it also helped me understand why heroin is such a seductive drug for lots of creatives before the pernicious side of it really kicks in.
I don't want to say any encouraging words for that, but I think anytime you're an artist, it's sort of about lowering the noise, tuning into that one chord. And so with someone like Basquiat, who has so many ideas and was constantly learning, you could see at a moment that it might help him narrow the bandwidth. Yes. But I don't want to say encouraging words about it.
Look, we have to remember, he's dead because of his drug addictions. And so any sort of positive notions associated with it, you've got to park. I mean, it definitely helped him. It's helped lots of people be creative, but you know, getting over that addiction is hard. And when people have very serious drug addictions, stories generally do not have happy endings. And so I think it's important to understand the role drugs played. It's also important to call out that he's dead because of them.
Yeah. And of course, some people have mentioned that Basquiat was overexploited. I mean, how do you feel? Because it's a complex story.
I don't think that's true. I think exploitation narratives have just become so popular over the past 20 years. I want to give this guy the agency that he exhibited. He was smart. He was ambitious. He had high standards for himself. He wanted to be successful. He figured out how to navigate. To think of Basquiat as being exploited, I think, runs counter to almost everything I learned about him. You know, it doesn't mean that galleries weren't banging on him to produce more work to put in shows that they could sell. That's true for every artist. In much the same way, record labels, we got to get the next album out. The commercial realities of being a creative put pressures and demands on you. I think it's easy to flip into an exploitation narrative. I think that diminishes Basquiat's achievements. I think his drug addiction issues were evident in his life before he became an artist, before he became a musician. His addiction issues were probably accelerated by the pressures he chose to put himself under to be a successful creative. But those addiction issues were not created by the art.
Yeah. When anyone's in demand, it just, you know, he was ravenous for new experiences, too. And he was creating things that people were ravenous for. So he had his addictions and we have our addictions to him in a way.
Exactly. People are doom scrolling the form of addiction today.
Yeah. And fame, and people have said art can be an addiction. Yeah. So, I mean, having led Christie's of the Americas, you've seen, as we've discussed, how icons are made and amplified. Beyond Basquiat, what do you feel are those key ingredients that turn an artist into a global brand?
They have to have created something that's new, fresh, and distinctive for their day. So all of the great artists are there for a reason, and they're there for a reason because they rebelled in some way, they created a visual vocabulary that felt fresh and new, that excited people. So the great artists are not built on sort of anthills of sand. They're built on things of substance and of meaning, though is not a sufficient condition to become an icon. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition to become one of the greats that's accepted. I think you have to have a interesting and vivid personality or personal narrative that makes you interesting for people to talk about and want to learn about. I think you also have to have a support network of galleries, of curators, collectors who are excited about your work and want to push it forward and don't want it to be forgotten. And so I think those are factors. I think it's also, if you can always remain part of the sort of relevant zeitgeist, that's also important. And Basquiat has benefited enormously from the pivot in the art world that started in the 1990s to identity being such an important part of what, at least in the contemporary art world, came to view as, you know, incredibly important and relevant for some artists to be considered important. So again, I think Basquiat's visual vocabulary distinctive, stands out relative to what was being done in the 1980s. And so that's the sort of strong hill on which his reputation is built. I think there are just so many interesting stories, and he's such an interesting personality that helped propel him. There were, you know, collectors and curators who gravitated around him and who wanted to be part of that story and push him. And then the zeitgeist really pushed and promoted him. And it ended up making him be the Black artist that curators and collectors wanted to be talking about. There are so many great Black artists who were active in the 70s and 80s, many of whom today have been found and pushed into the forefront. And you find them in museums, you find them in auction houses. But, you know, Basquiat benefited from being the first Black artist of note that got pushed forward. And as in many things, the first benefits, if you're the fifth, sixth, or seventh, you still benefit, but he's benefited from being the first. And so there's something very pragmatic. It's the economist in me that thinks about these things.
He created the market, or he and his unseen collaborators before, during his lifetime and after created the market.
Yes, yes. You know, it's interesting with Basquiat today. I'm old enough. I remember the days when Jackson Pollock was talked about in pejorative terms, you know, and at some point in the 70s and 80s, like, nobody would ever say anything bad about Jackson Pollock because he'd become such a well-known artist. Like, you didn't want to seem like a sort of cultural cretin. You know, Basquiat's achieved that status today. I mean, it's rare to find anybody say anything negative about him because he's so part of the zeitgeist. And even if you don't know that much about art and you're not that, like, you're going to say good things about Basquiat. You don't want to be viewed as a cultural cretin.
Exactly. And the fact, as you identified, that he really made that crossover in his lifetime into pop culture. So we can all, like, tune into him and get something else out of it. What do you think, what has the art world learned? Have we learned anything from Basquiat's rise about equity, representation, and the treatment of young artists of color, and maybe how we can, like, be more attentive and mindful?
So I think if you look over the past 10 years, the art world has made a hard pivot to embracing overlooked, underrepresented artists. And so, you know, if you are a transgender artist from Pakistan doing interesting artwork and you're ambitious, your work's going to be seen, it's going to be recognized. I mean, the art world has done a hard embrace of that. In much the same way, it's looked back in time to fine artists over the past 100 years, living or dead, who were overlooked. And so I think the art world is one of the most inclusive, looking for overlooked, underrepresented artists. I think, not that people don't say this, I mean, it's hard if you're a female artist in today's world. I think it's hard to say you're being discriminated against in the art world. If you're transgender, you're gay, if you're Black. And so I think we can revel in that being a good thing. There's still too many galleries trying to push an artist because they fall into some marginalized category. And there's a little bit too much emphasis on that as opposed to the quality of the work and how people can enjoy it. And, you know, the art world's starting to sort of pivot back a little bit from that. But the art world is probably, people might find this hard to believe, but in contemporary art, it embraces everything. It's not going to embrace MAGA stuff, but it's going to embrace most things because it feels very important to people in the art world to be open-minded, to be accepting, to be quizzical, to embrace. So those are adjectives and adverbs that motivate a lot of people to want to re-explore accepted canons and figure out who else was out there doing cool work in the 1950s that we don't know about.
We'll take a moment now for a recorded interlude on the life and legacy of Jean-Michel Basquiat. This is from Patrick Healy, an author, philosopher, and former lecturer in aesthetics at TU Delft's School of Architecture and Design.
I thought this was a delightful conversation. Dirk and Mihir had a wonderful exchange, which moved initially on the point of why does an artist who has died only in 1988 already achieve payments for individual works of up to $100 million, and in fact, secure one of the highest prices of any modern artist in the 21st century. And you have to ask yourself the question today, what is happening to what you call the art world and the way in which the hierarchy of galleries, international affairs, of organization of criticism, museum shows is going hand in hand with strategies of investment for commodities. So are we looking at the last stage of the commodification of art? And are we looking ultimately at the last stage of the commodification of the artist? So I think when Mihir was asking the question about generative AI creating art, where you no longer need the human signature or the human mark, as she referred to it, that was a question that was very difficult to understand. Because if you say that market forces alone determine value, then it doesn't really matter who has made the work. What will only matter is the price of the work. And that really goes back to the 1980s itself in New York, where New York was trying to become the cultural capital of the world, taking away the whole traditions of modernity from Paris, but without the background that brought into being the modernity of Paris. In other words, it was accessing it as product, as something that could be managed and sold. This becomes a very key fact in having artistic fame. And Basquiat's very interesting. He is connected right back to the early expressionists. So we refer to him as a neo-expressionist. And I think that's not incorrect, but one would have to understand that in a very precise way. The Americans had had huge impact after the war with somebody like Hans Hofmann and the development of abstract expressionism. I only have to mention Rauschenberg or Clifford Sale or Jackson Pollock, of course, must be the most exemplary artist of pure expression. And Matisse was saying, my whole art is about expression. I want to find expression through color becomes the way in which in 1905, when they're in Coilure with Derain, the color explodes. And it, rather than line or shape, becomes the way in which the artist's inner feeling is being communicated. Kandinsky wants to do the same through music. That's also precisely what Basquiat is doing. He's almost kaleidoscopically responding to the blitz of constant image that's coming at him from every direction. And he is negotiating that with his own expressive iconography, motif, and language. So in one sense, he's very traditional, but the sense in which he is not traditional is that he accepts complete flatness for the surface. He treats his works as if they're large posters. He is not using color as the expressive means, but he is using words So there's a very strange way in which we don't have a manifesto written by him, as we do with Matisse, with his Notes of a Painter, with Kandinsky, the Spiritual in Art, or the Blauer Writer Almanac of 1911. We have instead words, as if all of his feelings about being African-American, about being an artist, about the oppression he experiences, his commitment to political activism, are all just down in one word. And the images that are haunting him, you can say it goes back to Gray's Anatomy when he was sick as a child, and people have made those arguments. I'm not going to add to that body of knowledge particularly. But I do have to say, I think these that have been left out are his Catholicism and his desire to find heroes, his desire to find warriors, saints, his need for people like Warhol to be around him, experienced elders within the art world, which also opened him to enormous exploitation. He was creating constantly inwards and then using an enormous scale, almost an exaggerated advertising billboard, to communicate what he was concerned with, which if you look at the work, the 10 years where he's hugely productive, I think that publicity posters and cinema posters, all this way of registering very simple, single images is part of the power of pop. And it's what Andy Warhol does as well in his series. And the second thing is not just the simplicity of the image, but also grab it in one go. And strangely, the person I think who understood that incredibly well very early on was David Bowie, who was an early collector of Basquiat. So I think that the story about the three big collectors may be true in terms of the money, but the reputation's there almost immediately. He's one of the youngest artists ever to be exhibited at Documenta in Kassel. So somehow the world that lies between Joseph Beuys and Andy Warhol, on one side this shamanic, highly creative, mysterious artist about animal life and about the earth and ecology, and Warhol on the other side with money, glamour, sophistication. They all somehow meet in Basquiat's work because his language, the words he uses, his political engagement are all under the cover of what Freud would call the death motif, the Thanatos drive. And he's the almost biggest example I know of where you look at his art, you see there is a destruction and a death wish from, you know, very earliest imagery. It may be cartoon-like, it may be collaged images, and a lot of pastiche and sources. He's grabbing things as he sees them. But I think he lives in such a speedy way, he also lives almost towards death all the time. So when you get this report of his overdosing, you know, you regret it, but you think it was probably inevitable because he would have ended up in a kind of self-referential loop because he was diminishing the iconography downwards. He wasn't expanding his themes, so he was constantly drawing and creating the same things. Doug's economic way of looking, you have a very canny, knowledgeable person about markets and money, who's also trying to say that the story is not very different to the stories that Vasari tells. You know, a gifted child found on the side of the road, brought into Florence, set up in the Bottega. It's exactly the same story we're getting on Basquiat, who actually Basquiat was from a relatively comfortable background, was multilingual, reading avidly since he's 4 or 5 years of age. And he is also, and I agree with Doug on that, I think he has real ambition and he knows that there is a game of networking, of meeting people, and he has a lot of luck. He meets the people who are prepared to recognize his ability. I mean, he has an article about his work in Art Forum. He's brought to Documenta when he's 21. Even today, this is very precocious. But going back to my story of Paris a little bit, in 1910, Picasso was sitting in a room with an art critic who's 21 years of age. Picasso is 25. And the dealer is Daniel Henry Kahnweiler, who really creates Picasso's market for him. Because these people are very sophisticated in their marketing strategies already. Modern art has always had this. It was created by the relationship between the critic, the dealer, and the artist. Today, the relationship is between the artist, the curator, and the collector. The critic is less and less important. And what is happening now is that extremely wealthy collectors are creating blue chip market value, but they're also taking the words out of circulation. And Doug made a very important point. When did you last stand in front of a Basquiat? And this goes back to the problem that in the image world, everything becomes just known as a picture. Because I've seen it in cinema or I've seen it in books or something, but I've had no experience of this. So the imagery is proliferating, the capacity for experience is being drained. So when Mia says, what about slowing this whole process down? The human subject needs time, needs a kind of sanctuary space to understand art, a place of refuge, given that we are under such sensory overload. Sensory overload leads to experiential deprivation. So on one side, art, which should enrich our sense and awareness of things, is actually becoming a means by which we don't experience things. And this is one of the great final paradoxes of what has happened to art in the 20th and early 21st century. We're not educating people in a way to understand that a visual world needs as much study and time and attention as learning to read and write. And I think that when you bring up the idea of the creative itself, yes, there is the creative drive, but what happens to it later is something else. And we have to be vigilant about that. Because what's really happening is it's just winner takes all. So if you win this lottery art game, you get everything. And then everybody else has to just literally scramble for a living. The system is making it more and more difficult for artists to actually have a decent, dignified, honest income. And that's something that really needs to be addressed. Because otherwise we are looking at what Doug rightly says is a blockbuster culture, that only the top bestseller counts. And what Mia was talking about, the spirituality or the suffering that's needed to create beauty or the individual signature of a human creation gets lost sight of, because it only becomes a game of you're successful and the rest of you are losers. Well, maybe Wittgenstein's idea that philosophy, the person who comes last in the race, may be the winner. And I think we have to open up again a lot more situations where communities support artistic practices to enable people to survive without having market forces dictate to them what they need to do. Because galleries say to you, those yellow works you did, they've all sold. You should do more of those. And it doesn't become about your actual personal exploration or your understanding of your own life, what you want to communicate out of that to others. And my third and final idea is that on one side, Doug says at one point, Basquiat must have felt very exploited. On the other side, not when he dealt with drug taking. And this is also part of the myth. I mean, this goes right back to the Beat generation. There's a kind of acceptance of manic energy. I think that's also there in Basquiat. It's a Dionysian energy, and it's an energy that comes and probably exists still today, mostly in the area of music. Because the kind of punk music and hip hop and so on, this was the anarchist philosophy of the early expressionists still going on. We forget that Matisse was considered to be an anarchist. Picasso was considered to be an expressionist. That these young artists were considered to be in rebellion. That the collectors who bought their works were saying, we're liberal, emancipated people. They're lending works. They're giving their own Van Goghs to museums so that people get a sense that there's something here that is against what the Kaiser wants, against what the powers that be have decided the look and shape of the world should be. And that's where the radical politics of it is. And I think that in Basquiat, you get that too, real politics, Dionysian dimension of hip-hop, punk music. I think it must be taken into account to understand what he did. So that rebellion turns an artist into a global icon. They have to be rebellious. They have to have a visual vocabulary. There must be some kind of meaning. But actually, the interesting thing about Basquiat is he doesn't just want to tell stories. His provocation is that there's a condensation of feeling down to a word and image. And that's exactly the process that Matisse talks about in The Notes of a Painter. And that's the strangest thing. The real genius tension in Basquiat is how can it be that the death drive can be shown in a decorative way? Only art could do that. Only art could give us in the way that tragedy lets us look at something tragic. But that tragic knowledge which we have doesn't mean that we have to end up dead on the stage. So I think there's part of what's very profound in Basquiat. And I think that's a profundity that belongs to the autonomy of art. And I think it's not about post-colonial identity politics in that sense, because I think you're holding the artist hostage to ideological fortune. And I think that even if all those discussions are either ended or resolved or don't exist anymore, the art still is a place of radiance in which truth shines forth. And now back to the interview.
Yeah, and I think the Basquiat story is great. I mean, in terms of giving younger generations something to strive for, because I think in every wannabe, there's a Basquiat striving to get out. And you can follow that line and say, yeah, it's possible. And with the bit of gutsiness and going up to the right people. Now, I mean, the difference is now he did it in a very, I think, strangely lo-fi way with the postcards, doorstepping people. Hey, look at me. Warhol, buy my postcard. And now it's done in social media. So it's, I don't know, easier or more difficult. I'm wondering what your wider reflections are on how that has changed the way art is being made, the way we're receiving art, the whole question around generative art. Are we being so flooded that we can no longer see? How is digital technology and AI changing the art we're making and how we appreciate it?
Yeah, no, it's an important question. I think the answer is still a bit unknown. This might be a bit controversial, but with social media, if you want to be seen, if you want to be recognized, if you want to be talked about, you can push yourself forward that way. And there are discovery mechanisms that enable people to learn about you. I think there's something really impressive about that. It means it's hard today for somebody to say, I have a story to tell and I'm not being heard. If your story's not being heard, it may be because you're not choosing to put it out there. I think if you're a very private person, social media is anathema to you. So you have to be a bit of a narcissist to do it. I think social media has definitely made it possible for people to be seen, noticed. I think there's just so much. The world has become just flooded with visual images. That just wasn't the case 40 years ago, 30 years ago. And so I think when you're just barraged with it, people's sort of visual acuity has declined as opposed to increased. Because unfortunately, you know, do you snatch somebody's eyes in 3 seconds? Because if it takes you 30 seconds, they're not going to look. I think art and artists have suffered from that because the art world, while it's still, lots of people go to museums, its relevance in the broader cultural world has actually declined. If you look at the sales of art, price adjusted, it's declined dramatically over the past 10 years. So the cultural relevance of contemporary art has actually shrunk as opposed to grown. Most people will find that to be a shocking statement, but just look at the growth of where people are spending their time. It's far less on art-related endeavors. The relative importance of art has shrunk. And so I think social media has helped but hurt it. I guess AI was created because social media companies and digital platforms needed ways to have more effective chatbots. So generative AI was created for a commercial reason. It just has ended up being a way to create text and visual images in ways that nobody in 2017, when those technologies were created, knew was going to happen. It's definitely hurtful to creatives who are unintended victims of that. I think it's going to lead to a world of creatives where the blockbuster mentality is going to rule. I think all these technologies are just going to reinforce it in ways that there's a certain sadness to it, but unfortunately, there's no turning back. The genie's out of the bottle, and it's going to be a tough world for a lot of creatives.
Yeah, I don't know if there's already kind of a Basquiat chat bot. I'm sure the people are generating their, you know, a few lines of text, and they can be a Basquiat, or try to be on a digital level. There is a lot of unfairness in terms of copyright in that, and also in terms of, I think, we need the struggle. We need to put the 10,000 hours, or that, I think that's the bare minimum.
I am so with you. I'm a 10,000 hours guy. Being creative, it is such hard work. You have so many false starts. You've got to learn. You got to try. And so, look, there's a lot of creative slop out there. I think people are maybe thinking, well, all these generative AI tools are going to enable me to become an esteemed creative faster without having to do the 10,000 hours. I don't think so. I think it's, look, you can use ChatGPT to write something, but oh my God, just read it. You know, it's not very good. You're going to have to edit it. You're going to have to transform it. You're going to have to push your thinking. And so Those are attributes associated with hard work, determination, and lots of people are comfortable doing that. And I think a lot of creatives are going to use these tools to push themselves even harder. And those that do that and have the sort of agency to put themselves in that position, those are going to be the blockbusters in the future. I don't think many creatives are going to be able to hold their nose and go, I don't use them. I think creatives who are ambitious are using them now, and they're using it as a tool to push themselves, but they still know it's more of a 10,000 hours and use these tools to maybe make it 8,000 hours, maybe 5,000 hours.
I think what's emerged from conversations with different creatives is that those who are later on in their career definitely know how to do it from start to finish without AI. But because there are others coming up behind them who are so reliant on AI that I feel like they kind of have to jump on the bandwagon just a bit because they cannot produce as quickly. It's sad, really, because these really talented people they will only use it a bit.
Yeah. Well, one last point on generative AI that is, to me, really interesting. Look, the uptake of generative AI in corporate America has, despite all the publicity and all the little tests, has been really slow. It hasn't actually changed much in corporate America. And the fundamental reason why is generative AI is based upon predicting the next word in a sentence or creating the next image. Truth is irrelevant in generative AI. And so generative AI, look, just use ChatGPT. It's fraught with errors and made-up stuff. And that's because the essence of the technology that underpins it, it's not based on truth. It's just based upon trying to predict what's the right next word. And so generative AI's impact in corporate America, again, is very low because you can't use it in a financial institution for a chatbot if it's creating fictive content. In the creative sector, however, that's not that much of a problem, because sort of truth and fidelity to historical records isn't as important. It's sort of like, you know, if you've got a video that has a figure that has a sixth finger in it, if you look really hard, you'll find it, but it's not necessarily going to mean that the video is bad. Generative AI, it's not going to go away. I think its impact on corporate America for the next 5 years is going to be far less than what lots of people think, because it just has so many errors in it that just makes it hard to use when somebody can sue you if you're giving bad medical advice based upon it. But the creative sector, it's here to stay. And so I think it's going to be around. And I think those who embrace it and use it to, you know, who are already creative, already know, to your point, the sort of end to end, it's going to accelerate them. It's going to make them more productive. It's going to help them become the sort of blockbuster drug, if you will, in the vertical that they're active in. It will be interesting to see how does a 25-year-old who hasn't gone through a full journey of writing something or painting something, how is it going to affect their thought processes? Because it's still hard work to come up with something that's cool, interesting, and you can look yourself in the mirror and go, this is new. There's a twinkle of originality here.
Well, that's really interesting because what we know about, going back to the subject of addiction, is that addiction, or we're addicted to social media, other technologies, it's triggering our dopamine, right? And so it becomes addictive, the AI, and what you're asking about, what it does to our brain, it leaves no space for it. When we're so young, our neuroplasticity is still developing. We're creating in a manic AI sphere or a manic, you know, digital sphere, too many connections in a way, without the necessary empty spaces that allow us to dream. I mean, that's my own feeling of it. You know, it's just so kind of crowded. And I think that, can you imagine a basket painting where there's no empty spaces? There are empty spaces, right? And that's why I feel like AI, there's no empty spaces.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great point. I think that's a great way to describe it. That idea of empty spaces. If everything sort of gets filled in so quickly, you don't have time to think, to reflect, to ponder. As you were talking, I was thinking, oh my God, what would have happened if Jean-Michel could have just put into ChatGPT, here are 10 ideas, do a mashup of them, please, and went with it. You know, at the time he was created, there's no way we could do that. I'm sure somebody will create a Basquiat mashup app where you can toss in name that idea and it'll produce something. I mean, there's something sort of sad and pathetic about that. But I think the challenge for creatives is this is the world we're in. So how do you embrace that zeitgeist and then figure out, okay, how am I going to create something that stands out? Maybe there need to be more pauses in it. Maybe we need to find ways to promote reflection, to give people those moments. Creatives throughout eons, they've had to deal with new technologies, new challenges, social norms. Will be interesting to see how visual artists, where there's just so much slop out there. Look, most of the stuff that ChatGPT and these other algorithms create as visual images, oh my God, it's just slop. But what is interesting is, you know, lots of creatives who use it to get like 40% of the way there. Like that's what graphic designers are doing. Like graphic designers, you know, they've been hired to do something. And so they know the task, but they don't know what the answer is yet. So they're using these tools to sort of pepper their brain with ideas, but they're still having to go in there and do something that's unique and original. It's just going to be fascinating to see how the slopification of visual images is going to raise the bar for what a creative has to do to stand out. I look forward to seeing that because I know it's going to happen. Actually, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. I haven't seen anything quite yet, but these technologies have only been changing the creative landscape for the last 24 months. So we're still in early days.
And so that's why I think it is helpful, of course, really important to have those gatekeepers, to have those, in a way, tastemakers. People don't know. Speaking of your own role in the creative process, as you reflect back on your experiences at Christie's and now as a managing partner at Art Fiduciary Partners, how you're helping people see with clarity, you know, what they do with their collections, what their collections tell them about their art. This is very mysterious to me. So if you could explain it and what your journey on that.
Well, maybe to the broader point first, I think tastemaker has become a pejorative, you know, influencers pejorative for good reason. I mean, you read a lot of what they say. It's like, oh my God, it's like hold their nose. I think people do crave sort of thought leaders who help you understand what's important and why. And I think the tastemaker world right now is just, it's too tinged with celebrity. It's too tinged with likes. And I'm constantly searching for tastemakers that I want to listen to and follow. It's actually hard to find that nowadays. I do think the slopification will create more demand for that. And I think people may find this weird, but I think auction houses sometimes are a good place because auction houses don't really shape taste, they more reflect taste. And so what's being sold at auction is actually always an interesting place to look to see what's capturing people's attentions. Because, you know, auction houses are like just total commercial places. They're in the business to sell things. So they're sort of reflecting what's of interest. I think curators at museums who have some mileage on their experiences, they're good places to look. But it's interesting, museum curators, most of them are still very reticent to speak up and talk. They do shows and that takes a lot of time. So I think people worth listening to, it still is hard. Like Vanity Fair 20 years ago used to sort of provide that role. It doesn't anymore. You know, The New Yorker used to, it doesn't really. I mean, so many of these publications are tied up in sort of political agendas or wanting to be accepted by the cool crowd. There's not as much independent thinking and a sort of forthright determination to do that in pop culture media nowadays, which is sort of sad. But these things, there's always a pendulum. These voices will emerge because there's an innate demand for them, finding them and those people finding a way to step forward and do it in a public way without feeling burdened or necessarily feeling like they've got to propagate a certain agenda to still be part of the cool club.
That's interesting, the cool club. And how can we free our minds to be drawn to what we're drawn to without all the valuations, which we can't help but being influenced by that. You know, I'm thinking now of mimetic desire. We don't know what we want, so we turn to others and follow what everyone else wants. But really, we know it's much better to follow Socrates or Seneca or Kierkegaard or all those who stressed the need to think for yourself, to create a real relationship with the art, with the world, and avoid following the crowds.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, like on a personal note, you know, what was the first work of art that you bought? Or what was the first work of art you wanted to buy, maybe couldn't afford to buy? What started you on that path? Because as I said, it's not an easy path from being an economist to being in the art world.
The art bug bit me when I was very young. It was when I was in high school. Actually, I lived in Toledo, Ohio at the time. My girlfriend's father was opening the first art gallery in Toledo. And I remember he showed me in the basement prints that he had bought in New York that he was going to be selling in Toledo. It was the first time I saw a Picasso. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And I was like, why is that expensive versus this other print that you're going to be selling? Art's always been a way for me to think about history, think about what was meaningful and why. And so I'm always interested in the stars of a moment in time, who stood out, who was doing something fresh, who was doing something new. I love Raphael's work because he was extraordinary in the first half of the 1500s for his innovations and his drive and ambition. Kandinsky is one of my favorite artists because Kandinsky was the one who said, let's leave representation behind. How do I just use abstract imagery? A ballsy act. Saul LeWitt, one of my favorite artists, where it was, gee, let me write down a set of rules and instructions on a sheet of paper, and that's the art. So all of those, again, Raphael, Kandinsky, Saul LeWitt, you know, the connective tissue between those three is they were extraordinary innovators. They had purpose and ambition, and they created things that visually are very meaningful and interesting to me, and I never tire of seeing their work. And so those are the artists that I love. And there are many others, you know, Ruth Asawa, who has a retrospective up at the Museum of Modern Art, like an astoundingly wonderful artist. I can't afford her sculptures, but I can afford her drawings, of which the one behind me is one. Can't afford Kandinsky drawings, though I'd love one. I love Alice Neal, and I can afford her drawings, but her paintings have become too expensive. I mean, I'm just not going to go spend $1 million on a painting. But I do collect, and I've always chosen to collect drawings because I actually love seeing the hand of the artist in the drawing. And they're also just much more affordable. If you can catch them before their career takes off, they're semi-affordable. But look, art by great artists, it's always been ridiculously expensive. That's just not going to change. Can you spot them young, or can you spot them before the markets also decided they're great? That's when you got to buy it because it just becomes unaffordable.
Yeah, and I'm also interested in the psychology of collecting. I mean, because how people use it to tell their own personal biography, obviously it's an investment vehicle too, but like, what could you reveal to us about that in your many years at this?
So collecting for a long time was a private activity because people bought things, they hung them in their homes. They liked being part of, let's say, Leo Castelli's, you know, platform or, you know, his program because they like going to the shows, they like the community that they develop. But these were more sort of private moments. I mean, it's just fascinating to me how collecting for many people has just become a way to propagate their public image. Reading articles about some collector waxing poetic about their collecting journey. There's something I think distasteful about it because I think it's keep it private, don't make it so public because you're sort of bogarting the artist as a way to sort of suggest that you have sort of cultural cachet. You just had a lot of money and, you know, I think private journeys are more interesting. So it was always interesting when I was at Christie's. I love spending time with collectors because the vast majority of them, it's a private enterprise. It's a private activity. And they actually love talking with people who know something about art and know about collecting. And it's sort of sharing their interest and passion in an artist and why. And so I think collecting is best done as a private enterprise as a public enterprise. That's not the gestalt today. Certainly not what we did with Christie's. When you were selling a collection from somebody who died, it's like you want to evangelize that collector and their taste. And you do that for commercial reasons because you want to draw an audience. You know, I was party to all that stuff. I like the private journey of collecting as opposed to the public journey of collecting.
I think that's true, although there's no denying there are certain collectors that go beyond being a collector. Like, I was just there with the fellows from the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, and I think, of course, of the Guggenheims and Peggy Guggenheim. And I mean, they're really in some way shaping the art, right? Well, in many ways, and very personally involved. So I do, yes. I have to say, there is a salacious element. I like to know those stories.
Totally, totally. One quick story. There's a fellow, his name's Leon Black. Leon's, I think, in his 70s. Leon is one of the wealthiest people in the world because he created this powerhouse private equity firm. I mean, Leon's worth billions. Used to be a trustee at MoMA. They kicked him off because there were some issues. But it was interesting getting, we don't phone each other at home and I've lost touch with him. But Leon is a voracious collector. And so I did get to know him when I was at Christie's. And he's pretty private about his collecting, though people write about it a lot. It was just so, like, the depth of knowledge that he had in each category that he collected, from archaic Chinese bronzes to great work by Picasso to this killer collection of Van Gogh drawings. And so this was a private activity on his part, and he loved this stuff, and he could talk about every work that he bought and why, and he remembered where he bought it. People will find this hard. Like, Leon's a very interesting collector because a total obsessive compulsive private passion in multiple categories who can hold his own with specialists in each of those categories that he collects. There's something really impressive about that. There's something that met a need on his part to collect and own great things across human history. I remember he bought a drawing by Raphael for $50 million because he loved Raphael, but Raphael paintings don't come up for sale. So he splurged and bought a Raphael drawing because he wanted to have this drawing hanging in his home. Thank God he did that rather than wanting to buy more food. It didn't drive up the price of food.
Yeah, I really like to hear that dedication that breaks beyond market and investment and, you know, that scholarship, that it is about connecting us to history. There's this phrase I think of called mimetic desire, the desire to want what the other wants. And, you know, when we're just like following the masses, but it's so lovely to hear about these collectors who are aware of that, but are following their own music.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting that triggers. There's a chapter in my book where I profile five collectors. And I did it because before Basquiat met Warhol, his visual vocabulary was set, his ambition was set, and he was already producing great work. And so I wanted to profile the collectors in 1981 and 1982 who were buying his work. And across these five collectors, they bought like over 60 works by him. And it's interesting, all of them were deeply passionate collectors of contemporary art who studied, who read, who looked. These were not, you know, fake wannabes who were collecting art because it was going to give them social status. They were buying Basquiat because they thought his stuff was really good and they had educated eyes. And so I wrote that chapter for a reason, because I wanted to make sure readers understood why Basquiat was important early in his life, because he did come up with something new and distinctive. And the proof points were educated, smart collectors going, there's something cool here. I want to buy this. And they bought multiple works by him. And they weren't buying it because they thought, like nobody knew he was going to be this successful. Like, give me a break. And so the people who are passionate about art and have the money to pursue it and do it in a more of a private way, they're very interesting people. They're extremely interesting people because there's a depth of knowledge and a rigor to their pursuit that makes them interesting and relevant. And the artists generally love it because they realize, oh my God, these are informed people. Because they think I'm cool, it gives them confidence. The celebrity collector who's buying something, it's like you get the glow from it. The collectors who are serious about it, and again, they got to have a lot of money to do it, don't get me wrong, but they're choosing to do it. There's something cool about that and lovely. And they're very interesting people to spend time with. You would love spending time with them, and you probably have, because you're very intellectual. You like ideas. You like to express things. You like to go for a deeper truth. That's what these people do, too. That's what makes them decide this artist is interesting and relevant.
That's important to know, because I think that a lot of people think, oh, it's an elite activity. Of course, as you say, you need to have the money to do it. But it's a way of getting us to feel and think, and all of us can have that experience. It's the price of a museum ticket or a free entry to a gallery. So it can touch us. I still think that visual art, blurring of the different disciplines now is very relevant. Maybe, I mean, this is my opinion, and then I'll ask for you in closing, because you've been very generous with your time. But I think even more relevant now with all the noise, if you're presented with an image, as you say, that you contemplate for 10 minutes, that's yes. A meditation. That's bringing us back home to who we really are. It connects us to our dreaming mind. And I think that always has to be relevant.
I agree. One hope I have, which I doubt will be met, I hope museums will change how they choose to exhibit art. Because right now, for most people going to museums, it's just a cacophony of stuff. Museums almost lack the courage to do a show of 10 great paintings by Van Gogh or 10 great paintings by Basquiat. I think museums have to actually provide more of a place where people can meditate and go deep. I think the world would benefit from it. It would also make the cost of running a museum a whole lot lower.
Exactly. We have to think about the future of museums and also at our ecological point in history, the carbon footprint on things. So a lot of people are rethinking that, I think, too. And in closing, as you think about the future, the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I guess have a greater sense of optimism. By most objective standards of infant mortality rates, food security, longevity, this is actually one of the greatest times in history to be alive. And I think Homo sapiens have a long track record of solving problems and making things better. And so I think having a greater sense of optimism about the future, because while there are lots of intractable problems, with time, solutions do emerge. Again, that's just the history of humanity. And, you know, if you compare today to the dark ages of 1944 and World War II, like, this is a pleasure palace. And so I think having a greater sense of optimism about people being able to do things and create things, I think more of that is needed, because on both left and right, everybody wants to scream and be upset. But I think a greater sense of optimism is needed. And I think just look at objective facts, which can help you sort of go, maybe things aren't as desperate and awful. Because in a sense, throughout time, things have always been desperate and awful. It's just you sort of have to have an ability to rise above and look at in a more abstract way. How does this really compare with previous moments in time? And oh, maybe, look, things are troubled and things are difficult and there are horrible things that are going on. But maybe it's not as bad as I thought if I just have a slightly longer time period with which I form my opinion.
Well, those are important thoughts. And also make time for beauty and art in your life, because that really...
Absolutely. Yes.
That heals all if you give it the time it needs.
Yes. Go chase sublime experiences.
There are many of them out there, and you have written about it so beautifully. Thank you, Doug Woodham, for helping us understand the story of Basquiat and the making of him as an icon and bringing us this insider's view of the art world, which is so often shrouded in mystery. I think by helping us understand the missing chapters of Basquiat's story, you help us contemplate the past, present, and future of art. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Creative Process is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Featured contributor on this episode was Patrick Healy. Associate interviews producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support was by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram at Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.